Thank you, sir. Everyone here will be thanking you in a minute that I have this, I think. Well, welcome again. And what you just saw here this morning, the singing and everything, we're actually taking on the road next week. Those of you who know are smiling, right? Yeah. So we'll be over at Plymouth next week and the next week, actually 2 weeks. So you'll be able to catch us there. We're talking about crisis this morning. And when we get to Daniel chapter 2, it is about following in a crisis. And how people handle crisis is a pretty deciding thing. There's a story about two guys who were on a cruise ship, and in a storm, they both fell over the side and they wound up on some island in the Pacific. And it was just a wee small island, you know, and not one that you would think that people were going to come by all the time. And for one of the guys, it just occurred to him, the reality, they were going to die. And he starts running around this little island that you know, maybe was about the size of this room. And he says, there's no water, there's no food, nobody's going to find us, we're going to die. And he's screaming, and this other guy is just standing up against a tree, just kind of relaxed, trying to stay out of the sun. And it really starts annoying this guy, who really understands the situation. So he runs right up to the guy's face and he says, there is no water, there is no food, they're never going to find us, we're going to die. What's wrong with you? And the guy says to him, I make $100,000 a week. And the guy says, what does that have to do with anything? We're going to die. Don't you understand? There's no water. There's no food. Nobody's going to find us. What does making $100,000 a week have to do with it? And he says, well, you have to understand, I make $100,000 every week. And I tithe 10% of that every week to my church. My pastor will find me. I know it's a bad joke. But, you know, we're going to be talking about that. What do you hope? Where is your hope in a place like this? Now, everybody has a reaction to disaster. I mean, we all have that kind of thing. But it's like, where is what you've built into your life the place that gives you something to hold on to? And that really is the deciding factor, right? Because all of us have those weird reactions and lose our sleep, but it's like, where is the place that we go to find peace and to find stability and to find our balance? Well, we're talking about the book of Daniel, and the book of Daniel starts out with a great deal of disaster, and it gets worse today. Actually, chapter 1 is the thing that leads into chapter 2 to show you what the situation was. Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego had lost everything. These teenage boys were faced with losing their families. They lost their nation, their culture, their language, their religion. They're living in a hostile environment where they're going to be forced to have to submit and to have to go along with the rules. So they lost their freedom. They lost their names. They all have Babylonian names, which are names of praise to another god or other gods. And they had to learn the culture, the values, the religion, the academics of a pagan culture. So what happens when in your life when the reset button gets hit? You know, we all have heard stories about people who faced financial disaster and basically had to walk away from it with the clothes on their back. And it isn't just that. These guys are living in a whole different place. They had a great country. And these boys, since they were believing boys, they really understood that there was God. They understood who Yahweh was. They understood the promise to Abraham and the destiny of Israel to uphold God's name. And all of that had come crumbling down. But was it really all lost? So last week we talked that God gave them understanding, that they knew within their hearts that what had happened was exactly what God had promised. It isn't that God wasn't working anymore. God did work, and he led the people into exile because of the fact that they had fallen away from him. They knew that God was still in charge. So God had given up Israel. But they hadn't given up on God, and neither had God given up on them, and that's what you'll see today. They wanted to keep their hearts pure before God. Instead of eating food that had been offered to idols, they could have compromised. It would have been so easy to compromise. But they took a stand for God, and God gave them favor. God was with them. If you know the song, he never let them go. Shadrach, well, forget it. And they wanted to live for him in this pagan society. They wanted to be light, whatever that meant, and I'm sure they didn't have a roadmap. I'm sure there was nothing in their experience that told them how God was going to use them, but it didn't matter. They were going to use their lives for him in every opportunity he gave them. And it said God gave them knowledge and wisdom and understanding. And at the end of chapter 1, it says they came up on Nebuchadnezzar's radar as being pretty good guys. Well, we'll see where that leads today. Now, Daniel's education was 3 years. And that's going to fit into the story a little bit here. And you know, if you read your one-year Bible every year, and this is the first time I've ever seen this, what I'm about to show you, every now and then God gives you some surprises. Daniel's education was 3 years. Now, it's also the case that in 2 Kings, which we haven't gotten to yet in the one-year Bible, it says, in his days, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came up in Jehoiakim, became his servant, 3 years. Now, so when Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah are taken captive, Nebuchadnezzar walks into the city, and he just takes a few people. He still wants Israel intact, but now Israel is under him. Jehoiakim now, the king, has become his servant. Very important event, because the minute that Nebuchadnezzar put his foot in the city, the clock for the exile started ticking. Isn't it neat that Jehoiakim obeyed Nebuchadnezzar 3 years? What a coincidence. Isn't that great? Well, I mean, that's luck, right? That is luck. That Jehoiakim, before he broke away from Nebuchadnezzar and went rogue and brought the wrath of the Babylonian Empire back onto Jerusalem, he at least obeyed for 3 years. The entire time that Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, and Daniel were being trained. Because I don't think Nebuchadnezzar would have been too happy about the fact that he had Jewish boys there in his system, and now their country had just decided to go with Egypt. I just say it's a neat kind of coincidence. So these boys, as we see them today in chapter 2, have been newly graduated. Every indication is that they had gone through this 3-year education, and it wasn't probably exactly 3 years. It's like when we say a person's gone through a year of school, that doesn't mean they've gone through 12 months of school. Usually a semester is, what, 4 or 5 months? So there's some give and take in here, but it works out pretty good. And they were newly graduated and probably had jobs. Anybody here just get a job? Newly graduated, you got a job. They're maybe getting the first Babylonian paychecks in. But suddenly, it was like a bad dream. So if you have a Bible, look at Daniel chapter 2, which just happens to be about a bad dream. In the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. Now, let me just say this. The second year of Nebuchadnezzar, they did some timing back then, and I don't understand it. I just trust everybody who tells me about it. This was actually probably his third year. They didn't count a king's year until it was one complete calendar year starting from the first day of the year. So, for example, I came to this church. I'm not Nebuchadnezzar, but I came to this church in April. Well, they would not have counted that as a year of anything. They would have waited until we got to January 1st, and that next full year to December 31st would have been 1 year. They wouldn't have counted April to December for whatever reason. So when we see him at the end of his second year here, that means he's already reigned two full calendar years starting at January 1st going to December 31st. The time before that isn't even counted, so it very likely could have been 3 years. I'm only saying that to coincide with Daniel's 3 years of education. In the second year, you're going to have to put that clock up here so I can finish by about noon. Okay, in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams and his spirit was troubled and his sleep left him. Then the king commanded that the magicians, the enchanters, the sorcerers, and the Chaldeans be summoned to tell the king his dreams. So they came in and stood before the king. And the king said to them, I had a dream and my spirit is troubled to know the dream. Then the Chaldeans said to him, and some of your versions will say, in Aramaic. Okay? Now, this is very important because up to this verse, verse 4, everything has been in Hebrew. Because everything is really pertaining to the Jews. Now, what's so funny is if you read a lot of commentaries, the commentators will tell you there is no, they don't exactly know why. But I think we can figure out why from here on out until the end of chapter 7, it's in Aramaic. Because what is going to happen here, I believe, goes into the official records of the Babylonian Empire. What happens here from now until the end of chapter 7 is going to have to do with not only the Babylonian Empire, but something about the nations and how they're going to be changing. And it's going to have to do with the time of the Gentiles, a lot of other stuff like this, but it's going to be Babylonian, so therefore it has to be in Aramaic. Very important little point. But we'll see. So, they say to him in Aramaic, O king, live forever. Tell your servants a dream and we'll show you the interpretation. And the king answered and said to the Chaldeans, the word from me is firm. If you do not make known to me the dream and its interpretation, you shall be torn limb from limb and your houses will be laid in ruins. But if you show the dream and its interpretation, you will receive gifts and rewards and great honor. Therefore, show me the dream and its interpretation. And they all had coughing fits. That's somehow in there in the Aramaic. And he answered a second time and said, let the king tell his servants a dream, and we'll show you its interpretation. And the king answered and said, I know with certainty that you're trying to gain time because you see that the word for me is sure. If you do not make known to me the dream, there is but one sentence for you. You have agreed to speak lying and corrupt words before me until the times change. Therefore, I tell you. Therefore, tell me the dream, and I shall know that you can tell me its interpretation. And the Chaldeans kept coughing and answered the king and said, there is not a man, this is the wrong words, by the way, for this guy. There is not a man on earth who can meet the king's demand. For no great powerful king has asked such a thing of any magician or enchanter or Chaldean. The thing the king asks is difficult, and no one can show it to the king except the gods whose dwelling is not with flesh. Do you see what's going on here? I mean, Nebuchadnezzar really, really, really wants something. He wants to know what this dream means. Now, the two options here are these. One, he's dealt with these guys before, and he realizes there's some creative, spontaneous interpretation that they've done on stuff, and he's probably thought in his own mind, oh yeah, and that he doesn't want that. Or it could be that he still remembers parts of the dream. But have you ever had this where you wake up with a deep feeling about a dream you've had, but you've already started to forget the specifics of it, but you're still left with that deep feeling? Well, it may have been a mixture of the two things going on here. And you can enjoy this, but the point being is that what is happening now with Nebuchadnezzar is very grave. God has shaken him up, and these were his go-to guys. Let me ask you a question, and particularly if you're still looking at things from the outside and you're wondering, you know, is Christianity really a thing? Where do you go? And there, and I'll ask you, your neighbors, where do they go when they have a problem? Where's a place of stability? Where's the place for answers? I remember one time reading an article in Germany how many of the people in their government went to see astrologers and palm readers and mind readers. I went to a mind reader one time. She only charged me half price, you know. But you go someplace, right? You go to your group of friends. You go to that in Milwaukee. It's the corner bar. You go to the corner bar because that's where your buddies are, and that's where you can hash out the things of life. And what happens when your friends are no longer supporting you and they're not a help? And what happens when you go to places where you normally can get an answer, but something keeps burning through? I remember when I used to be on drugs. That was the thing that killed me. It's because, you know, drugs in a good time are just fun. But when something goes wrong in your life, and this issue keeps burning through everything, it's just like you're left completely empty. There's absolutely nowhere to go. That is Nebuchadnezzar at this point, because God has shaken him so badly. If these men who are supposed to give him answers, this religious system that was going to give him answers couldn't help, and these guys fall back on, oh, well, hey, look, that is with the gods with whom man has no contact, then it's like, what good are you? And that comes out in the next verses. Because of this, verse 12, the king was angry and very furious and commanded that all the wise men of Babylon be destroyed. So the decree went out, and the wise men were about to be killed. And they sought Daniel and his companions to kill them. Now, one of the questions is, why is Daniel and his companions part of the wise men? They were just going to school. Well, I think in the Babylonian system, when they got done, they got vetted. Just like we would with graduates from any kind of a general educational thing, we assigned them a job track. And I think these guys were so good in the way God had blessed them with some spiritual understanding and understanding of other things. The Babylonians were very much into mathematics and stars and things like this. So these guys apparently got tracked in this way. Bad luck, right? I mean, why not be a garbage man at this time in your life as opposed to being a wise man, you know? But it comes down on Daniel and his friends. And so Arioch goes out to get them. Now, I just want to say this here. What I think this was a gathering of all the wise men. I don't think this was door-to-door assassination. I think they rounded them up, you know, knocked on the door early in the mornings. These guys come to the door, you know, wearing their saucers, apprentice pajamas with that hat and all that, and they grab them and throw them in a wagon or something like that. That's what I think they were doing and hauling them off for execution. Imagine what that would have been like in the city of Babylon. Imagine people knew these were the wise men, like the priests and the enchanters and the astrologers and everything. This news would have hit the marketplaces, right? I mean, people, the whole place would have been buzzing with what was going on here. So Daniel, verse 14, replied with prudence and discretion to Arioch, the captain of the king's guard who had gone out to kill the wise men of Babylon. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, why is the decree of the king so urgent? I think these were still like teenage guys, maybe around 19 or so at this point. And I'll tell you why in a few minutes. How many people do you know, when somebody comes to the door and says, hey, we're going to haul you away and kill you, go, here's what I would do. Give me a minute. Run in the back room, tell the guys we'd knot all the sheets together. We'd go out the back window. We'd be on our way out of that city booking. This guy has this kind of reserve, this kind of calmness. And Daniel says, and it says here, Arioch declared to him why the king had made this command. And Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. I just think this takes a lot of stability. And you know, our first reaction isn't always the best reaction. I know mine isn't, you know. And it takes me a while to find my spiritual equilibrium. And I would just say, this is something that the Word of God has been given to us for. Time after time after time, you see crises in the Bible. Anybody reading a one-year Bible this week read about the Assyrians standing at the gate of Jerusalem. And if that didn't look hopeless, I don't know what did. And in one night, God turned everything around. Therefore, we have this little motto that I heard, I'm sure Howard Hendricks stole it from somebody, but I'm stealing it from him. We are constantly confronted by amazing opportunities brilliantly disguised as unsolvable problems. Excuse me. I am very certain that Hezekiah didn't think there was any way out of that but God, and he just stopped there because you don't know what God's going to do. What God did the next day was completely out of the playbook. And what God is going to do here, this actually makes Daniel chapter 2 one of the most amazing chapters in the Bible. Chapter 3 will be totally unprecedented, but you have to wait for next week and the road trip for that one. This is really amazing what's going to happen here. So, back to the Bible. Sounds like a good name for a radio broadcast, doesn't it? So, verse 17. Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, his companions, and told them to seek mercy from the God of heaven concerning this mystery, so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise guys of Babylon. Then the mystery was revealed to Daniel in a vision of the night. Then Daniel blessed the God of heaven. Daniel answered and said, "Blessed be the God, the name of God forever and ever, to whom belong wisdom and might. He changes times and season. He removes kings and sets up kings. He gives wisdom to the wise and knowledge to those who have understanding. He reveals deep and hidden things. He knows what is in the darkness, and the light dwells in him. To you, O God of my fathers, I give praise, and you have given me wisdom and might, and have now made known to me what was asked of you, for you have made known to us the king's matter." I'll tell you what I like about this prayer is the fact at the end that he mentions you have made known to us. I mean, we look at Daniel and we forget Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, but these guys were on deck. Actually, they are the three heroes of chapter 3, right? An amazing chapter. But these guys were in it together. And I told the youth last week when we met, you know, one of the things you have to look for, I mean, it doesn't matter how much faith you have, you've got to find people of like faith, kindred spirits. We don't talk about that anymore. We are used to unsteady alliances and people who barely kind of get together and we think we're going to get God's work done. I don't think so. And I don't think Daniel would have been Daniel without Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And surely he was leading them. And surely it was his faith that was an inspiration to them. But all four guys went on their face before God. All four guys wrestled with God. Daniel got the vision, but Daniel mentions here in humility that they were part of it. So, verse 24, and I'll just say that to you. If you're going to go into a ministry, find good friends. You need good friends. You need good hearts. Keeps faith alive. Okay, therefore Daniel went to Arioch, whom the king had appointed. This is the third time it said, whom the king had appointed to destroy all the wise men of Babylon. Apparently, Arioch was a very intimidating dude here. And he said thus to him, "Do not destroy the wise men of Babylon," which means they hadn't been destroyed yet, so they were being gathered. "Bring me in before the king, and I will show the king the interpretation." Then Arioch brought in Daniel before the king in haste and said to him, "King, I have found among the exiles of Judah a man who will make known to the king the interpretation. So if you'd like to give me a raise, feel free." I always like that. "I have found a nice guy." Anyway, so the king declares to Daniel, whose name was Belshazzar in Babylonian, Are you able to make known to me the dream that I have seen and its interpretation? And Daniel answered the king and said, the wise men, enchanters, magicians, and astrologers, no wise man, enchanter, magician, or astrologer can show to the king the mystery that the king has asked, but there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries, and he has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the latter days. Now, let me just say this. This is just sort of a little bit of trivia and Bible study. Do you remember that word, Chaldeans? No magician, enchanter, or Chaldean. But it never said what the Chaldeans did. The Chaldeans were kind of like the root of the Babylonian Empire. Remember, called Abraham was called out of Ur of the Chaldees. Okay, so it's kind of the old time traditional whatever they were, and apparently they were pretty good on astrology. But because of the word Chaldeans not being used there, it kind of defines the word Chaldeans for you. They were astrologers. Anyway. But there is a God in heaven who reveals mysteries and has made known to King Nebuchadnezzar what will happen in the latter dream. I've got to finish this paragraph here. To you, O king, as you lay in your bed, came thoughts of what would be after this, and he who reveals mysteries has made known to you what is to be. But as for me, this mystery has been revealed to me, not because of any wisdom that I have, but more than all the living, but in order that the interpretation may be known to the king and that you may know the thoughts of your mind. Now, let me just say this. Daniel does some pretty significant things in that little statement there. The astrologers and the Chaldeans and the enchanters said, and wise men said, the information you want is unreachable by men, because that information is only with the gods with whom no men have contact. And what Daniel is saying here is this God has chosen to give you this information. Now, and Daniel is saying, it's not because of me, it's because of him. There is loads going on here. And, you know, I mean, on a personal level, just think of that in yourself, that this God in heaven has chosen to give you information. You know, and I've said, and you probably heard me say before, you know so much more than so many other people on this planet. And I'm not just talking about non-church people who don't know about Jesus. If I could take some of you and send you to Siberia, and some of you, I'd gladly do that. Paul's raising his hand, he wants to volunteer. Anyway, you would get there among Christians, believers in Jesus Christ, who don't have a fraction of the information that you have. You would be like Bible scholars. And we sit on this information, and sometimes it gets so old and dusty and boring to us. And the God of heaven has made known to you the most important information on the planet. I mean, don't give yourself a pat on the back. But that is pretty, pretty cool. And Nebuchadnezzar is not going to miss the point. Now look at your watches right now. You realize there's no possible way I can get out of this, right? And therefore, I'm going to do this for you. And this is very strategic. I'm going to skip the vision. And I'm going to skip the vision because of a couple of reasons. One is I don't have the time. Two is that in terms of understanding this chapter, most people who read the vision miss what actually happens here. What happens here is completely cool. We'll cover the vision in chapter 7 because chapter 7 is a mirror image of this vision that Nebuchadnezzar sees. Now, most of you know a little bit here. He sees a statue. It has a gold, the head is gold, Babylonian Empire. The breast is silver. That's going to be the Persian Empire. The thighs are bronze. or the torso is bronze. That's going to be the Greek Empire. The legs are iron. That is going to be the Roman Empire. All of these empires, there are other empires in the world. I mean, the British used to say that the sun never set on the British Empire. But these empires had to do with Israel during some of its most crucial history. Therefore, they're mentioned. It doesn't talk about the Chinese or anything like that. But these empires had to do with God's people. Now, there's another empire. That feet that's mixed with clay, that's going to be something different. And not only that, it says that it's 12 toes, or 10 toes, whatever. 10 toes, yeah. Isn't that normal? We have 10 toes? Anyway, that's bad in math, and many of you know this already. So, during the days of those kings, those 12 toes, that's what God thinks of those kings, they're just 12 toes. Anyway, in the days of those kings, there will be a rock cut out with no human, by no human hand, and it will demolish the control that any of those nations have ever held and will set up a kingdom that will be forever. And we know who that is. That's Jesus, right? So we'll get to that when we get to chapter 7. But I want you to see Nebuchadnezzar, verse 46. Then Nebuchadnezzar fell upon his face and paid homage to Daniel and commanded that an offering and incense be offered to him. But before you get disturbed by that, and the king answered and said to Daniel, truly your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you've been able to reveal this mystery. What just happened to Nebuchadnezzar? You know, if you understand what God is saying to Nebuchadnezzar, he says, you are the golden head. And there would not be another ruler of any of these nations that would be the equal of Nebuchadnezzar. God saw something in Nebuchadnezzar that is, people are still trying to figure out what that was. But God revealed himself to Nebuchadnezzar through Daniel. Nebuchadnezzar falls on his feet before God, not before Daniel. Daniel is that representative. Remember, that's a God that doesn't have any dealings with mankind. Well, holy moly, he has dealings with Daniel. And he's just spoken to me. And Nebuchadnezzar worships God. Wow. That is a big thing. Hard to find a pagan king. As close as we've come to this has been Naaman the Syrian. When Naaman was healed of his leprosy, he went back to Elisha and he says, now I know there is no other God in any nation but Israel. We're going to have to watch Nebuchadnezzar here to see what happens to him. But this is pretty big for this important pagan king. All right, so what happens then? Then Nebuchadnezzar gave Daniel high honors and many great gifts, iPads, iPhones, Apple computers, seriously, and made him ruler over the entire province of Babylon and chief prefect over all the wise men of Babylon. That ought to kind of take your breath away. What was the province of Babylon? In other words, the empire, the Babylonian Empire was pretty big. What was the province of Babylon? It's the showcase province. It's where government sits. It's where one of the seven wonders of the world is. This is, if you guys were planning a vacation, this is where you'd go. Don't go to Egypt and those dusty things in the desert there. You go to Babylon. It's right on a river. Beautiful. One of the seven wonders of the world. He built that thing for his Kurdish Persian princess. And Daniel is now the chief of the province of the seat of power. Holy moly. And he's over all the wise men of Babylon. I mean, the guys who had seniority, boom, he goes right up to the top of the list. Why? You know why? Because they just called off the execution. I mean, these guys were probably mad at Daniel and Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah because of what's about to happen here. But that's the thing to understand. They were as good as dead had it not been for Daniel. Now, there's some things to think through here. Where would the news of this had gone? Well, I'll tell you what, in Babylon, in the city of Babylon, this would have been all they would have been talking about. Because publicly, these guys were gathered for execution, and now publicly they're being released. So what happened? Don't you always want to know what happened? And the word gets out that this happened. Who in the world is Daniel, who is now our ruler? How old is this guy? And I'm just going to say, this is such a testimony to God's steadfast love and faithfulness. How old is Daniel here? There are clues in the text, and I'll just tell you, I'm not really sure. They chose men because they were young. They wanted younger people they could train up, because if you get too old, you know how we are. We don't change anymore. But on the other hand, if you're going to be the head of anything, you don't do that to a younger teenager. And we're going to, I'll show you something in a minute here that's pretty important. So I'm going to guess that Daniel could have been about 19 or 20 right now. I'll tell you why that's important in a minute. But here's the deal. We have people, I don't know if you realize this, but we have people who signed the Declaration of Independence. Some of them were 17 when they finished their doctor degree, and they knew three languages. We don't have the edge on education. We've more lost it than gained it. Some young men and women show all sorts of potential. So how old was Daniel? I really don't know. But here's the thing that I want to show you. In the last thing that we read about Daniel in chapter 1, it says, Daniel continues until the first year of Cyrus. Daniel continues longer than the first year of Cyrus. You'll see Daniel popping up in the third year of Cyrus. So the clue is, if Daniel continued longer than the first year, why does it say at the end of chapter 1 that he continued to the first year of Cyrus? What happens the first year of Cyrus? The 70-year exile comes to an end. Daniel is going to be used by God for all 70 of those years of the exile. And here's the thing, reason this chart is important. The exile hasn't really quite even begun yet. There are three times that Nebuchadnezzar takes people into exile. The first time is right here. This is when Daniel is taken, and that started the clock. The next time will be 10 years later, and Ezekiel and basically about 12,000 craftsmen and well-educated people are taken, because what Nebuchadnezzar wants to do is not destroy the country, but he wants to humble it by taking their educators, by taking their craftsmen, by taking their well-educated people away. So in 10 years, these people get taken away. And in another 10 years, he comes in and he destroys the temple. And he takes the bulk of the people captivity. Here's what I want you to see. 3 years into the Babylonian captivity, there are now four godly Jewish men in Babylonian government. I mean, that was the one verse that I didn't read right at the end that I should have. It says, and Daniel made a request of the king, and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel remained in the king's court. So the people haven't even really, in bulk, been taken into captivity. They estimate that what Nebuchadnezzar did that first time was maybe take anywhere from maybe 3,000 to 6,000 people away. The bulk of the people haven't even come. When you went into exile as a country, you lost your identity. It was cultural extermination. How is God going to keep his people together? And you know, the other thing too, is when you realize what happens between here and here, that's the book of Jeremiah, and you see how God is trying to deal with the people, and they are rebelling against him. But he has already shown them mercy. He has already shown them mercy before they get there, because when they get there, there are four Jewish men in Babylonian government. And these aren't just guys. These are really, really important people. As we get going and talk about the book of Daniel, there'll be some things I'll be speculating on. But here's the thing to remember. The Jews are one of the only people in all of history who came out of deportation, not only as an intact people, but they came out stronger. When the Jews leave Babylon, they have formed the synagogue system, the basis of the synagogue system. When they come out of Babylon, there is a textual family of the Bible, the Babylonian textual tradition, that gets developed there. How in the world did that happen? When you became a people living under other people, you were supposed to be exterminated. Wait till you see what happens next week. Next week is an amazing chapter. So before the other deportations, God has already placed his people in Babylonian government. Daniel continues until the first year of Cyrus. I got ahead of myself. This is where it says in chapter 10. If you're just reading through, you go, wait a minute, I thought it said the first year. It's the third year. God is using Daniel. God saved the nation through these four boys. And in his grace, mercy, and love for his people, God bent the wills of the nations and kings through the lives of these four men. That's what you're going to be seeing. Through Daniel, God prepared the nations for the return of Israel to its land and for, ultimately, the coming of a king. This is pretty good stuff. Isn't that neat? You know, we get into crises and things like that, and we don't often realize that God has already gone before us. You know? I think of Kyle last year getting word that he was going to get laid off from the railroad. And not even knowing it, God had already planned some stuff for him, you know, and it wouldn't be just repairing homes and doing lawns for the rest of his life. He got at least for what right now is a fairly decent job, right? To know that God goes before us. To know, and how else can God write that on our hearts, right? Unless he actually takes us into the situation. You can learn so much about Jesus and so much about Christianity and so much about the harvest and all this stuff that we talk about and words that we throw around theoretically. But the only time that it gets burned upon your heart is when God leads you into that crisis. And now the question is, what do you do? What do you do? Who really is in charge? Is God back in Babylon? I'm back in Jerusalem, or is God back in Missouri, or wherever Mark Twain came from? You remember me saying that last week, right? Is God somewhere else? He seems awful quiet, doesn't he? But that's faith, knowing that God is still present. And what do we live for? Where is our hope? You know, I mentioned in that thing that I said during communion that there is a place of balance and a place of peace. And it is right at the feet of Jesus. It may not even extend 5 feet away from that place. But right there it is. Remember what Jesus told Martha? Mary has chosen the good portion. What was Mary doing? She was sitting at the feet of Jesus and listening to him. That's the place of peace. And that's a place where God oftentimes has such a hard time driving us because we're so busy. And take this as so matter-of-factly. And in that crisis, in that place, that's where we need to trust God that sometimes there are hidden opportunities we just are not giving him time for. We need to be patient. Can you wait for God in the storm? Expecting that he will glorify himself. For those of you who read the one-year Bible this last week, you saw Hezekiah. Utterly hopeless. spreading himself out before God, spreading this letter out before God. He had no clue how God was going to answer. The next morning, they open the gates of Jerusalem. The Assyrians are not only gone, but there's like five super Walmarts full of junk out there. iPads, flat screen TVs, all sorts of good stuff. And they were able to live on that until they were able to get back in their fields and replant the crops. Because God does amazing things. And he's the one we trust, and that's why the story is here. Wait till next week, it even gets better. Let's pray. Heavenly Father, we thank you. It is so hard to depend on you. It really is. I mean, to cry out and say, God, I just want to hear your voice. Where are you? Show me your glory. Show me something. And sometimes you just seem very quiet. But that's what faith is all about. We have a word that, the word that is alive. And these stories are here to strengthen our hearts. You never sleep. You never slumber. You don't fail us. So I just pray for every person in this room. I pray that you would strengthen their hearts in you. That you would not just give them hope, but that you would give them joy. Because we have been spoken to by the God who, according to everybody else, does not speak to human beings. But boy, has he spoken to us. You have spoken to us. And you've spoken to us in these last days through your Son, who endured everything on the cross for us, so that we might not only have life eternal, but live with him eternally and have a message that is nothing short of light for those who live in darkness. So we just thank you for your grace. Thank you for these great stories in history. And we just ask you, please, to give us patience and endurance and hope to wait on you and to let this flow into the lives of other people. And we ask this in Jesus' name.